To order, good morning. This is Friday, the 21st of January, and we're going to be having an informational meeting with the Department of Human Services on the overall child welfare structure. We're trying to get to that a little bit earlier this week. Just a couple of housekeeping items. Colleagues, on your agenda, there's an item for work session. We're not going to do a work session today on committee bills. Probably get to that at some point next week. We've also received, and you should all have a copy of it at your desk, copies of written testimony from Karen Stuve and
Stuvey
and Dorothy Harmon. So we will have staff enter that into the record, and we'll proceed on with our agenda. So if I could invite the Department of Human Services to come forward, please. I just want to take a moment to thank you for bearing with us earlier this week. I know that you had been set to present to us on Wednesday, but we went a little bit over our time on the public discussion, so we're going to figure out how we want to address public discussion on this issue in the future, because there's a lot of people that want to weigh in and offer their observations, so we'll probably continue on that later, but I do appreciate your patience. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ramona Foley, Assistant Director for Children, Adults, and Families at the Oregon Department of Human Services. And this morning we were asked to do sort of an overview of what the process looks like in Child Protective Services and foster care. And towards that point, one of the documents that you have in front of you appears as this funnel shaped. And this funnel document, what that's actually to do is to point out the total population of children in Oregon. And then of that total population, you see the 42,000 reports, how many of those reports actually have completed assessments, how many are closed at screening, and then of the assessments, the 31% that actually are founded for abuse and neglect, the total number of victims, and then of those assessments, the number of removals, and then the number of in-home safety plans. So when we talked the other day about approximately 20,000 cases that are open on any day, that's the total number of cases that would be in Child Protective Services and in foster care. And so this sort of gives you an overall size of what we're talking about when we talk about child welfare services. And this morning, Una is going to start by walking us through what happens when a Child Protective Services call comes in to intake, and then she'll be followed by Kevin, who will pick up the piece on children who are removed and placed in foster care and what are the various steps that that case goes through.
Good morning, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. I think we have some technical difficulty in terms of projecting this graph up on the screen, but you should have before you a page that up at the top of the page, it says screening, it says log, it says close at screening. It's a graph that looks like this. Oh, good.
Luna, could I ask you to state your name for the record, please?
Yes, I'm sorry, Chair Dalto. My name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for Children, Adults, and Families. I think that's as good as that we'll be able to get it. What I'd like to do this morning is give you an idea of what it looks like as we receive a call and as that information moves through our system. What I'd like to say to start with is that this will be an example. Certainly each call and each referral is unique, but we'll give you an example of what it looks like as that moves through our system. As a member of the public or law enforcement or a school personnel might make a call to our agency. They have a call of concern, a concern that a child is being abused or neglected. That information comes into a staff person that's a social service specialist, and that person is a screener. And the job of the screener is to determine if that information is indeed regarding a call of abuse or neglect, and if so, if that information would require us to make a face-to-face contact with that family and assess that information. So if you start at the top of the graph where we say screening, the screener's decision would be that if the information is not about child abuse or neglect, if the person who has called and really needs to get assistance from a different agency or perhaps needs more information about what constitutes child abuse or neglect, let's say if we have a person that calls and said, I need some assistance because the visitation that is ordered for me through the domestic relations court is not happening as I wanted it to happen, we might let them know that that's an area that they could pursue with legal aid or a different agency might assist them. Another issue that might come in and be logged would be that a caller says that the children have head lice and there aren't other risk factors that are identified in that situation. As we all know, any child can get head lice, and that's not necessarily an abuse or neglect situation. So that information might be logged. Another decision that might be be made by the screener is that the caller may in fact identify risk influences within the family. They may identify that they believe that the children are being neglected. They believe that the house is dirty. But as the screener listens to the information, they do not hear from the information the caller is giving them that there has been an actual event of child abuse or neglect, or that the information that the caller is giving them rises to that level. What they might be telling us about are risk influences. And among the risk influences that we hear about all families might be poverty. There might be a suspicion of drug and alcohol abuse. There may be a suspicion that there is there may be some arguments in the family, but we do not get sufficient information to have us go out and make a face-to-face contact. I think that's a critical decision because as we go to the family's door, we represent a powerful government agency no matter what we look like when we come to the door, and as we make that decision to intervene in a family and contact them at their home, we want to make sure that we have a reason to go there. And so the final decision that might come from screening is that the screener does determine that there has been an event of child abuse or neglect, or there is threat of harm that abuse or neglect may be occurring, and there is a threat to that child's safety. Probably a more obvious call might be that we have law enforcement on scene at a home and they have identified that methamphetamine are being produced in the home. There are children there and they're asking us to respond to assist with making a plan for those children and determining how we can best meet their needs. So as the screener decides that that needs to be assigned for face-to-face contact, the example I just gave would represent an immediate response. And that means that we have to go out immediately. We have to work with law enforcement immediately. There's something happening right now, and we need to address that. Our policy, our administrative rule, calls for...
Certainly.
Sure. Can I ask you as you go through this to cross-reference it to the... to the page I have in front of me that I assume you produced, the FFY 2002-2003 summary. There's a data page that you produced. I assume it came from you.
Funnel.
Yeah.
Could the funnel? Certainly.
So,
certainly.
So that my assumption is that the top of this is the 42,455 cases.
Yes.
For this particular year, and that close to screening over there on the right is the 21,903.
Yes, the figures that thank you for that, Chair Dalto and Representative Greenluck. Certainly, I'd be happy to make that reference. The 42,455 total child abuse neglect reports represent those calls that are coming into our agency. That number does not include those calls that are logs, because logs are calls that are not about child abuse or neglect. They're something other than that. So the 21,903 are the calls that I just referenced, where the person may be identifying some risk influences. They may be identifying information that they believe is child abuse or neglect, but we have not identified that there is a specific safety threat for that child.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you get a call that is, say, from a nurse, physician, someone who's required by law to report this. So I'm assuming that would be an immediate response if there is a good sign of neglect. Sounds like a true sign of neglect or abuse, correct?
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, the determination about the response to the situation is based on the merit of the information, and I will distinguish between what makes an immediate response, and we have two response categories. One is immediate response, and one is response required, which immediate response is within 24 hours, and response required is within 5 days. And the question I believe that you asked is, would the caller who is making the call determine whether it's an immediate response or a 5-day response?
I'm not asking that, but if it is a social worker, nurse, physician who is saying this child has signs of being physically or sexually abused, how soon would a response be made, and by whom would that be made?
Okay. Thank you, Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei. The determination of what response time we make once we decide that, yes, it is abuse or neglect, and we have made a decision to assign that information, would be based on the nature of the safety threats that are identified. If children are in a situation such as a home where methamphetamine is being produced, if we have a child who is at school right now with a current injury, if we have a disclosure of sex abuse and the child is in the home with the alleged perpetrator and there's direct access with that person, those are examples of situations that would require an immediate response from our staff. And the people that would be assigned to do that would be Child Protective Service workers. They're social service specialist ones that are receive specialized training in Child Protective Services assessments. A response that might be a 5-day response or within 5 days, an example of that might be that we have a child make a disclosure of sexual abuse about a previous partner of the mother, and that individual who's the alleged perpetrator is incarcerated in another state. That person is not representing a threat to other children and not representing a threat to this child right now. It's an issue that needs to be assessed, and it's one that we'll want to work with law enforcement on, but we don't have a situation where the threat is, the child is in immediate danger.
So would there ever be a situation when it would just be a police officer going to the home or wherever the abuse has been reported, or is there always a Child Protective Service worker going, maybe in addition to police or in their staff?
Okay. Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, the question is, would there be a situation where it's just law enforcement responding to the situation? The Child Welfare Services are identified to focus on issues where there have been there's an incident of family abuse, where there's abuse within the parent-child relationship or within significant other adults that live in their household. that. So in those situations, we are responding with law enforcement, and sometimes child welfare, given the circumstances, may have notified law enforcement. It isn't a criminal issue, and child welfare might respond alone. If there's a situation where a person identified as a third party is the alleged perpetrator, and that means that the third party might be a neighbor in an apartment complex or someone that is not a part of that child's family or household configuration, then that is a situation where we would be cross-reporting to law enforcement, but that is a law enforcement issue.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. And just to be perfectly clear, so a police officer responds to a meth lab, and I'm sure it doesn't happen like that, but I mean, a police officer responds to some kind of incident and identifies a child at risk in that home. The police officer will immediately contact, well, a child protective workers. That's one set of circumstances that you described. But another set of circumstances that you described was that a call would be made that law enforcement wouldn't automatically respond to. So somebody would call and say, I think that there's sexual abuse occurring in this house, but it's not law enforcement responding. It's an outside person reaching one of your screeners. And I just wanted you to clarify for me what the sort of instant response to that would be. So somebody calls, and then actually we have to go back and clarify how somebody could even reach a screener, but somebody calls, somehow the screener takes a report from an individual who's alleging abuse, but it's not a law enforcement related, you know, incident. You're saying that there's an instant response, but I just want to know how that works.
Chair Dalto, the question is, if we have someone other than law enforcement calling our screener and we determine that it's immediate response, describe how that process happens. A good example might be that we have a teacher or a counselor at school call and say that today we have Johnny at school. Johnny has a bruise on his face. Johnny is telling us that his mother's boyfriend slapped him last night. That's a situation where the call is coming to child welfare from the school. In that situation, we have both a child welfare issue in that that behavior happened within the family. We have a situation where we're immediately reporting to law enforcement, and in that situation, we would be responding together with law enforcement to go and talk with that child and assess the injuries and the nature of the situation, and then be working with law enforcement in talking to the parents.
Okay. So can you go back and clarify? Sorry, I'm sort of replaying an incident in my mind that I came across once, but trying to see how that fits in. I was in Beaverton once, going to the movies with some friends, and we were driving on a 45 mile an hour road, and saw an 8-year-old in underwear running across a 6-lane street, and thought that was pretty weird, and so stopped the car, you know, got out, and he was running back and forth because he was chasing a raccoon. And, but he was by himself, and we sort of figured out where he lived and made him take us to where his home was. We got to the home, and mind you, you know, as a young man, I try to avoid situations where I'm alone with children, but anyway, we get to the home, and there's nobody there. The kid's there by himself. Runs in the house, slams the door. There's a kid, and the kid was 8, and had his younger sister in there who was maybe 3, and nobody around, and we're trying to get attention of somebody to in the house or something. Wasn't anybody in the house? This is a, I don't want to go on, but we called the police, and the police showed up, but never did a child welfare person show up at that point, but the police was there to make the contact. They showed up immediately. So I'm just trying to see how that sort of fits into your system. I guess my next question is how the public knows how to contact your agency. How many screeners do you have? How does that work? Where are the screeners located? Obviously, law enforcement, the schools, those folks that are sort of trained to look out for instances of child abuse know how to get a hold of you. But how does somebody with a suspicion get a hold of you? Who do they reach? And, you know, where are they physically located? How does that work?
Certainly. Chair Dalto, the question is, how would someone know to contact a screener, and how is that sorted out around the state? In the Mologa County area, there's a child abuse hotline. Those numbers are posted and available in the same way that law enforcement numbers are available to the public. And
sorry, did you say the metro area?
In the Multnomah County area.
Oh, you don't have a statewide hotline.
I'll give you, Chair Dalto, I'll give you information about the statewide.
Okay.
So in the Multnomah County area, there's a child abuse hotline that covers the metropolitan area. And the number for the child abuse hotline is available to the public in the same way that law enforcement numbers are available to the public. So that child abuse hotline covers the metropolitan area. And in the after hours cover, the child abuse hotline also covers Clackamas County, Washington County, and Columbia County. In the rest of the state, in each county in the state, there is, and in some situations, we have SDA, service delivery area configurations. We have more localized child abuse hotlines, and those numbers, again, are available to people in that area to know how to contact them. So we could, in the SDA 3, Service Delivery Area 3, an example would be Marion, Polk County have a child abuse hotline, so Marion County takes calls for both Polk and Marion County. Yamhill County has a screener. What's important for the public to know is if they learn about an issue that they believe is child abuse or neglect, and that they live in Portland and that issue happened in Baker, they can call their local number. The statute allows for them to make that call in the area where they are. They can make that call locally, and it's up to us to coordinate that information. So each area in the state has a more localized screening. Screeners are located in the child welfare offices.
May I follow up?
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So in this situation, the representative also described, if he had called 911, he would have gotten the police, and therefore the police would have responded, but not necessarily CPS, right? Child Protective Services.
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, that's correct. There are situations where children are immediately in danger, and really the most appropriate call is a 911 call. Child Welfare Services has the capacity to do an immediate response, but not in the same way than a 911. If you have a crime in process, if you have a child who's at that kind of risk, then you call 911, and that would be a police response. Oftentimes what will happen is police will be the first responder on the scene, and if there are children then that child welfare need to respond and attend to, they will contact us. If we receive the call first, then we are required by statute to report to one another as those situations occurred.
Then would they be required to report to you in that circumstance when it seemed like this child at least was being neglected? So would they have responded to CPS about this case?
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, yes. The statute requires that we report to one another of situations regarding abuse and neglect.
I had been working in the school district for some years, and that was 10, 12 years ago. But at that time, whenever I made a report, it went to the police, and the police alone went out to check on that. So are you saying that has changed? So if you got a report from a school or a physician or from whomever, from a person who is required by law to report abuse and neglect, but that has changed so that the CPS worker and the police could go out, or just the police would
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, no, I'm not suggesting. The statute allows for a report to be made to law enforcement or to the Department of Human Services. And in many situations, the call may come to child welfare first from the school, or in some situations, it may go to law enforcement. We are then required to cross-report to one another and make determinations about how we'll work together in a situation. The reminder is that welfare focuses on family situations versus third-party situations.
If I can follow up, I'm sorry, I feel like I'm beating this one to death. But when I first worked as a social worker, the police and CPS worker would go out together. Later on in my career, it was just the police who went out. So I'm trying to understand if that is still the case or if it has gone back to both CPS and, yeah, and social worker, police officers right, going out together.
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, it continues to be true that law enforcement and child welfare can work together on that. And in many situations, they are responding together. That's a decision they make with one another. There are some differences in the state, but yes, we can both respond together. Yes, yes, and child welfare can respond alone.
And police can respond alone.
And police can respond alone, but we are required to cross-report to one another.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we should probably move on to the next phase of the flow chart, please.
Okay. So I think we've talked about the immediate response and the five-day response. I've given examples of those. When the worker responds within that, either immediate response within 24 hours or within 5 days, if it's a response required, what the worker's required to do is to do an assessment of the immediate safety needs of the child. So their first response, their first contact with that family is to determine what needs to happen now. What are the immediate safety needs of the child. The worker then has 30 days, up to 30 days, to complete a comprehensive assessment of safety and make some determinations about what service needs the family has. And within that 30-day period, or up to 30 days, they also make a determination of whether abuse or neglect has occurred, and if so, what kind of abuse. The three determinations that the assessor would make is this situation founded? Is this situation unfounded? Or is this an unable to determine? In child welfare services, the CPS assessment, a founded disposition means that there is reasonable cause to believe that abuse or neglect occurred. Unfounded means that there is no cause to believe that abuse or neglect occurred. Unable to determine means that there may be some evidence, there may be some indication of abuse, but there is insufficient information to make the determination that abuse or neglect has occurred. We move on. I want to just walk through very briefly what would happen if we have an in-home service.
Chair Dalto, quick question before you move on. You were describing the undeterminable situation. If, like you said, there wasn't enough evidence, but there's some, is it possible that when what happens, of course, then if it's determined undeterminable, and so then it's let go, what if in a case where there is some evidence but it's not enough or the right kind, or that caseworker decides in their own opinion that's not good enough for them and it goes on, then is that a lapse then if the next time it happens the perpetrator, whatever you call them, gets away with it, and so then it comes back harder on the child because they did get investigated? And how is that addressed with, say, in a second report?
Chair Dalto, Representative Boone, if we have an assessment that we in the end determine that it is unable, we are unable to determine that abuse or neglect occurred, the situations could, the reasons why we might come to that determination would be that there's unclear and inconsistent information, meaning that we have a different story from a variety of people, or we are unable to gather information, but there was some indication that we couldn't determine that there wasn't the presence of a situation, but we're unable to gather enough information to support that determination. And you're wondering if then the unable to determine would be sort of carried over to the next time we might get a call on the family. I want to be clear about the question.
Is there a note made or something that this is a little iffy?
Yes, that information is stored in our child abuse information system. We have that determination of unable to determine. And a requirement for our screeners when they're taking a screening call is to review all history on the case.
Okay. Thank you.
If I may, Chair Dalton, to that point, Representative Boone, as we mentioned on Monday, one of the concerns we have is the amount of data we do store. And since we don't purge data, while it's helpful to be able to go back and look and see if there was an earlier report, one of the things that we're trying to look at also is how does that mean 10 years ago? Does that mean 5 years ago? And I think that's an issue that we have to look at as we look at how we're going to streamline record keeping. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll ask you to bear that in mind to sort of offline. We can come back and work on that when we have the time to. But the two points that I wanted to just bring up were in the cases that you were unable to determine whether or not abuse occurred, or in the cases that you closed the assessment at the screening process because you, your office didn't determine that there was a safety threat. Do you have somebody going back into those systems to sort of look to see if those people are popping back up, you know, later on down the line? You don't have to answer that now. We'll take that offline. But also, we'll have a discussion about that in the context of your child abuse information system overall and how you manage the data. So we'll come back to that.
Chair Dalto, I'll continue quickly through the remainder of this first portion. The worker has completed an assessment, and at the end of the assessment, I said one of the determinations is whether or not abuse and neglect has occurred, and the parallel part of that assessment is whether or not a safety threat was present for the child. Is the child now safe or unsafe? If we have determined that the child, there's found an incident of abuse, excuse me, found an incident of abuse, that we need to make a plan with the family, then there we may move through a situation where we might, in fact, file a juvenile court petition. We may develop a service plan with the family and a service agreement. We will provide services to the family. We found that we can enhance the protective capacity of the parents while the child is still in home. An example of that might be where we have an incident of excessive discipline, physical abuse. There was an injury to the child. The parents are extremely remorseful. There was an amount of stress in the household. We were able to provide daycare for the parents. We're able to provide parent training. We have a family that we're working with. We have an extended family that's supportive and is now stepping in to assist the family. That might be an example of an in-home situation where we work toward a better outcome for the family. We continue to do face-to-face contacts with the family. And at a point where we believe that services and the child welfare intervention and the intervention of the court have resolved the situation that resulted in the abuse and the petition being filed, then we would move toward the closure of the case. And what I'll do now is move on to Kevin George, who will talk about when we have a situation where the child is unsafe and needs to be moved out of the household.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, for the record. I am the foster care program manager over the Department of Human Services. On the second page, or the backside of your chart, then I will walk you through the flow chart of out-of-home placements for children. In essence of time, I'll try to do that fairly succinctly and rapidly, and you will certainly flag me down if we're going too fast on this or have questions. When we use the term out-of-home care, that in essence encompasses what is really commonly referred to as foster care. But it's terminology within the organization that also includes children who are coming into care that might need treatment services. So they might be in a residential treatment center. They may be in a hospitalization. It's the whole gamut from the child has been removed physically from their biological family's home into the system of some sort. So that's where out-of-home care or out-of-home placements comes from. So once the decision has been made that there's a safety threat and the child needs to be removed from that that environment, we will try to have a team decision meeting. Will be the first step along the way. And a team decision meeting is something we've put into place here in the last year or so in policy. And it is a mechanism to where we will try to bring the family members together and with the department and really talk about a placement decision. Does this child need to be in care? And if so, who can care for this child? That is oftentimes tried. We try to have that done within the first 24 hours. More often, it's supposed to be done prior to going to court. As you'll see, we'll get down to the court piece here in a moment. But that is a decision-making meeting where we're trying to assess, does this child need to come into care?
Can I pause you for one moment, Kevin? Can you tell me who all is present at the team decision meeting?
At team decision meeting, we'll be open to the biological family, so the parents of the child, if they have relatives, anybody else they want to bring to that meeting. It will be the child protective service worker. It really is hopefully a decision that is being made amongst a number of people and not just the caseworker, not just the parent. But at that point in time, there's been no court action, no attorneys assigned at that point.
So I think I hear you saying the biological parents and people they might want to bring to support them and the child protective workers?
Correct.
No other parties?
At this point, no. No. It's certainly open, so if they have somebody else they want to bring in, it's not restricted just to family members, so they can bring in a neighbor or some other support person to them, but it's not restricted at this point.
Do you think it would be appropriate to have some level of law enforcement present in a meeting like that?
That's where the next step is. Again, this is really in the very first phase of, say, within the first, ideally, if we can get it done prior to going to court. Again, the court requirement is that we are in front of a judge within 24 hours. So you've got a body of work that needs to be done within that first 24 hours.
Representative Jensen?
yes, I think if I can just relate as far as this hearing, it's probably an area I get a lot of constituent complaints and concerns about. And basically, the complaints are that they feel it's a fait accompli when they go in there, and that it's not a team meeting, but it's a pre-decided sort of thing, and it's just an exercise that they're going through in order to conform with rule or law, as the case may be. On it. Do you have any response to that, as to the possibility of that hearing, of that being the case, or?
Is there any Chair Dalton
complaining, sir?
Yes, the significant.
The family is.
The significant members. Complaining about it.
Chair Dalto, Representative Jensen, my response is clear. That is a question out there with a lot of folks. We are, one of the things that we are looking at through utilization of the National Resource Center for Child Protective Services is the question of how do we use family meetings and to what level are we going to do you keep it open for everybody to really make a decision? Is that something that's just perfunctory that you just are doing because policy requires you to do that? How are we engaging in that with ultimately the decision still needing to be that the department is still held accountable by the courts and public to make good decisions on child safety? So as a child protective service worker, you may be in the room there having a family meeting and seven other people in the family may be saying, no, the child doesn't need to come into care, and you still have the responsibility and the ownership to be able to stand up and say, no, this child, because these safety issues are not being met, and that child still needs to be in protective custody, and the next step then is to go to court. So we are looking at those hearings right now. The question then, I caught two phrases of you, is the is it just the meeting, or is it also going into that judicial hearing, the shelter hearing, and is that already predetermined? The shelter hearing is the next step, really, in terms of there's a petition filed, then we determine.
Representative Greenlee?
This is really an interesting point for me to interject. I've been struggling about this all week, and it would be very useful if you keep this in mind. We're struggling between two good things. One is to keep families together, and our constituents are complaining as families that they're not, their rights aren't being listened to. And then the other question, how do we keep kids safe? And I think both of the terrible cases we're hearing about were when you try to get kids back to families, and that resulted in fatal events for kids. So it's going to it's going to be really interesting if you continue to comment as you go along how you deal with this constant dilemma with families who have rights and kids and your need to protect the safety of kids against the rights of my constituents, if you will. I mean, and that dilemma is, I think, at the crux of this whole issue, I imagine. So if you'll keep sort of commenting on that as you go forward, it would be very, very helpful to me.
Representative Dalto, Chair Dalto, Representative Greenleg, I think that's a well-informed observation, and it is a tightrope we walk day in and day out around valuing the rights and responsibilities of our agency and families and children all at one time. And oftentimes, in any type of meeting or court hearing, you may have seven different opinions, all which may be right to some degree at the same time.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the team decision meeting, if I understand correctly, it's just family members, maybe a neighbor, other people that would verify the veracity of the people, and the caseworker.
Correct.
Are there supervisors? Are there heads of department sitting on those meetings, or is it just the caseworker generally?
Representative Anderson, it will be the caseworker. There is a facilitator who actually facilitates the meeting. Oftentimes in some of our counties, that may actually be a supervisor. A worker may actually have their supervisor go with them to the meeting and then have another person to facilitate. In some of our offices, we may have actually a contracted therapist who actually is the meeting facilitator for those hearings or for those meetings.
But it's generally equal in terms of the people that come. It's not overly heavy with supervisors and other staff people kind of overbearing on the parents, making them feel uncomfortable.
I would, that'd be difficult to say at this point because I think we have a combination of all of that in terms of sometimes when you look at some of the families that we're trying to serve is that when CPS or the Department of Human Services knocks at the door for a family, oftentimes we're finding families that are disengaged from the rest of their extended family members. And so you may have just mom there who may not want to be letting everybody else know her business. She may not be wanting the neighbors to know it. She may not be wanting her parents or her siblings to know it. And therefore, maybe just be mom by herself at that beginning, or father.
I wanted to just comment to that also. I think you have to contrast that. That is a practice in the state of Oregon. You have to contrast in other states. In this scenario, the parents might not even see the social work staff until the case goes to court. And so the effort at trying to engage parents, and what I hear you all saying is there may be some created expectations when parents come to that meeting. They may think that the decision about the meeting is whether or not the child needs to come into foster care, when in fact that decision at the time the child is being removed, that is why the child's being removed. We don't think the child's safe in the home, and that meeting actually starts looking at alternatives. Are there grandparents, are there relatives or caretakers who are considered safe in order to minimize the trauma to the child of being removed from the child's family?
Representative Boone.
And that being said, that's kind of, I wanted to kind of ask one question. Number one, if there is a multidisciplinary team in place in most areas and how they figure into this, where do they come into the picture? And as Ramona, you just said, at that point, that meeting point, the CPS worker would try to determine if there's a family member the child could be placed with. At that point, if they say, okay, there's a grandmother, an aunt, a sister, somebody else in the family, are they screened at that point? And how does that fit in?
Yes, Chair Tomei, Representative Boone. There are a number of questions you just asked there. One is multidisciplinary teams. Those are really at the very beginning of a case on looking at the child abuse piece. We are further along and at this point in time saying that there is a placement decision that the police and the Child Protective Services may have removed the child last night, 2 o'clock in the morning, for whatever reason, and that child now is in a foster home at this point. So part of the essence of that meeting, again, as Ms. Foley talked about, was to identify relatives, and if it's grandma, is a good example. We then are required to then go out and start checking out grandma and doing background checks on her. We do a criminal records check. We do a home safety check in her home. We talk with references that she then provides references to us. And so there's a litany of things along that. We have a rule in our state that was implemented in 3 years ago, that we will only place children in certified homes. So that includes relatives or non-relatives. And so if it isn't relative, they must meet the same safety standards as a foster parent does as well. And we try to do that within the first 24 hours.
Representative Jensen?
Thank you. Madam Chair, you'll excuse me, but the further you go, the more confusing it has become for me. I'm sorry about this, and maybe the only person who is confused. I guess that's all right. One of the things I don't understand is when you say team, and we've got a couple of flowcharts here, and probably team appears in more than one place in these various flowcharts. I don't know that I have a definition or understanding of what a team is. In one of your discussions, it seems to me you're talking about a team being the caseworker and or maybe the caseworker supervisor. And I beg your pardon, but I don't perceive that as a team. And if that's the case, I need that kind of definition. And then I thought I heard you a minute ago saying that a decision has already been made that the child is going to be removed from the home and placed in some type of permanent foster care. And all we're doing with this team is looking for whether there is some type of family member or something of that nature that might be an alternative to, to foster care. So somewhere in the flow of this, I'm getting mixed up.
Chair Dalto and Representative Jensen, I certainly understand your confusion, and I'd like to back up for a minute and describe that decision point where we're seeing the team decision meeting. And as the worker completes their assessment, I said that there's one of the critical pieces that they do is determine whether the child is safe or unsafe in their living situation. At the point that the CPS worker in their CPS assessment with law enforcement, often sometimes without law enforcement, makes a determination that they believe that the child cannot be safe in their own home. Child welfare has moved to the practice of using a decision-making process called a team decision meeting. A team decision meeting is a form, it's one form of a family decision meeting. The team decision meeting is for the purpose of assisting the worker, law enforcement, and the family in making critical child placement decisions, the most important decision we make. So at that point in time, where we have a situation where we believe that there is no other recourse but to remove the child from the home, we call together a team. The team is essentially all the people that are available to us at that point in time to assist us in making that decision. As Kevin pointed out, it's an open process. The critical partners in that are the CPS worker, the supervisor, the family members, the mother and the father. Sometimes we might have another partner like a Head Start worker, a school counselor. We might have access to a treatment provider, but it's a decision that is going to be made regardless, and we've added this to our process to make sure that there's information that we're not, that we're considering all of the most important information for the family, that we do get input from mom and dad, from extended family, and that we can identify as early as possible alternative resources to foster care if the only thing that we can do is remove the child. So that's it, that team decision meeting point. It's a critical decision point in our case process.
Can I follow? One of the things you'll excuse me, and I'm trying to play, I think, a little bit on devil's advocate, on this. But you'll excuse me if I don't perceive the parents or whoever is the custodial care, providing the custodial care, as somehow or another being part of a team. I would see them as they fit into this scene in an adversarial. They would perceive the agency in an adversarial relationship, and that's a contest now. It's not a team sort of thing, and maybe that's what's kind of confusing me.
Chair Dalto and Representative Jensen, I'm actually not having grown up with this concept, having come here from another state, I actually had that same sense. And yet, when we have asked families, when families reach the crisis point that they have a child who's being removed, and the family realizes the thing I want to do is have something to say about where my child's going to go and what's going to happen next, that families actually, and we've actually been having some research done on these meetings by Portland State University to give us that feedback, the families actually see this as a better alternative than the department going behind closed doors and making a decision, we're going to place this child in X foster home, and then later we'll see what happens. And it really, the intent of that, and maybe it's the word itself, because I can put myself in the same place you're talking about as a parent, I don't feel like I'm a team member at this point because I'm not having equal vote on what's going to happen next. But at the same time, if I am able to say, if I can't care for my child, then I want my sister to be able to do that, and she's here today, in some ways it feels to me less adversarial than not even getting to participate in that discussion. So I think your advice, though, to think about how we call that and whether or not it creates a false expectation for parents, I think is a very astute observation about that thing called team decision making.
There was one thing that's, thank you, Representative Jensen. There's one thing that was a little unclear to us, where the and I realize you're talking about the team decision meeting, which happens very early on in the process on your chart there, right after the determination that the child is unsafe. So where does the multidisciplinary team action come in?
Chair Dalto, I think I can speak to that. Each county in the state has a multidisciplinary team, and within that team function, a part of the multidisciplinary team is the expectation that they will determine how law enforcement and child welfare approach child abuse investigations, and the assurance that there will be the consideration of all the factors, the law enforcement, the criminal aspect, and then the family planning aspect. Within each multidisciplinary team process, there is a part of that is the case review process. The MDT is an entity that can be called to review a case, not typically at the moment that we're responding. The capacity for them to respond that immediately is not there, but within a day, depending on the size of the county and the way in which the team functions within the county, it's an excellent process in terms of pulling together child welfare and law enforcement when we have a case that has considerations that are both criminal and family oriented, and when we have numerous issues to consider so that we don't interfere with one another's work. Primarily that would be the focus of that.
You're telling me what an MDT does, but you're not explaining to me how they work together with the child welfare system, because it's unclear to me whether, I mean, you're saying, well, if there's some kind of criminal action that comes into play with an incident, then it's helpful to have law enforcement and all the different child welfare partners reviewing it. I mean, I've seen an MDT meeting before, but I guess by nature all child abuse is criminal, and so I don't understand. Could you clarify?
Chair Dalto, let me take a shot at it. The multidisciplinary team is focusing its work around the child abuse issue, and either that issue has criminal implications, and sometimes it doesn't, but there might be an ongoing effort of the multidisciplinary team to continue focusing on, okay, this child had to be come into out-of-home care, but we're still going to pursue an investigation around the parent because we believe there was some criminal efforts on the part of the parent, a criminal wrongdoing. That that MDT piece can continue along that track. The multidisciplinary team does not usually serve as the safeguard for the foster care system. When you look down this sheet on the foster care system, there are a number of safeguards in place to make sure that the system is operating correctly. The multidisciplinary teams, their focus is the child abuse issue at the front end of the system, regardless of whether or not the child comes into care. Then if the child comes into care, what you see here, and we'll hear about later from Citizens Review Board, there are a number of safeguards that monitor the process once the child comes into foster care.
So is it a parallel process then, a report of child abuse with a criminal component of it will come in, and you'll make this determination that the child is unsafe, and you go to team decision, and you follow along on this chart. And meanwhile, the MDT is happening.
That is possible. That the MDT, as long as there is an issue that is of concern in that community, the DA may be coming to those. Usually, the district attorney will be attending those meetings. The sheriff's office, law enforcement will be there. There may be medical professionals. And again, as long as there's pending issues around the abuse itself, that team may remain active in terms of staffing those issues. But again, you have a whole different set of laws that will now trigger when the child has to come into foster care, and the laws for foster care are actually much more prescriptive from both the federal and the state perspective in terms of all of the safeguards that have to happen in the foster care system, okay, regardless of the role of the MDT.
We've got to move on, but just one last stab at this. So you're telling me that, if I understand this, we're talking about dealing with the child welfare issue in and of itself in the one stream that is depicted on this flowchart. The what happens to the kid and what you do with the setting with the kid, with the family, versus the crime that's taken place and how you will deal with that.
Chair Dalton, that is correct.
Okay.
Yes,
all right.
That is correct.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks. We'll need to move on.
Okay, Chair Delta, I'll move on then. The next boxes you'll see there is the out-of-home safety plan, so that is a placement into a foster home or relative home. Conjunctly, there is also then the petition filed with the juvenile court. That's based on the initial allegations that were called in that we may have information to determine this child has been unsafe. So petition is filed then with the juvenile court. We will then have a shelter hearing in front of a judge within the first 24 hours of business. And at that point in time, then we're presenting information that we have received from the allegation. Any sort of law enforcement response to that, we will be providing that. And a judge then makes the determination that there's enough information that says the child is unsafe and therefore they're going to maintain that child into a foster care. At that point, then, the judge will provide temporary legal custody of the child to the Department of Human Services. They then may also at that point in time assign attorneys to the parents. Again, it's through the public defense. So the parents are eligible based on income. They will then be appointed an attorney. They may also appoint an attorney for the child at that juncture. Again, that is what occurs within the first 24 hours.
And may I insert here, Chair Dalto, a piece that now as I look at this chart, and I've reviewed this chart several times, it's also important to note that the judge may also decide that the child does not need to remain in foster care. And approximately a third of the children who have to enter foster care, it is a temporary placement, and those children will be reunited after these court hearings or within 6 months period of time. About a third of our population still goes back to family, so I don't want to leave the impression that every child who comes into foster care is going to exit only through after this 12 to 14 month hearing.
So this sheltered hearing, you're saying, at that sheltered hearing, the judge could make that determination at that point?
Yes.
And it's about a third of the cases that happens?
Chair Dalto, in the first 6 months, about a third of the children, I haven't looked at that figure probably in about 6 months myself, we can get that figure, but about a third of the children will exit foster care because whatever that crisis was, with the child's removal, the family, all kinds of things come into play with the family to try to get the child back out of the system. And so families will be accessing services. They will be trying to make zealous efforts to have the child returned.
Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's at that point where either indigent defense is assigned or the family is asked to go out and get an attorney or, in some cases, represent themselves. But I see that there's a problem. I had a case in Josephine County that by the records from the AG's office and the county and the child's attorney, there was probably well over $50,000 spent on the hearings. The parents had been forced to sell their dream home and buy a smaller home to pay the attorney fees, which may or may not have been reasonable. And they were left without any money at all. And I suspect they were in better shape than most of the other families that are going through this. It'd be very difficult for me to come up with $50,000 to pay for more coverage, more attorney defense. And so I see a real problem that we're creating a real stacked deck where your department and the AG's office can come in and spend unlimited amounts, and the families can't really defend themselves. The family in this case, the wife became the attorney, and the judge was wonderful. He was a temporary judge, but he just led her through it step by step, saying, oh, you can't do that, but you can say this. Well, you know, it took 3 days to get, or 2 days to get about a three-hour hearing done. And I think we need to look at some way that we can equalize it. I was thinking, you know, maybe we should think in terms of tax credits for the people who, in fact, don't have the money to supply equal defense. That's a problem in this climate. Maybe we're not going to get indigent defense for a family that basically has some assets. They had a home. It was a small home, but it was a home, so therefore they're thrown out. They have to go out and get the cash to fight some pretty powerful forces. So I see a real problem in that area. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
That really leads me to the thing that's missing from the two critical cases we're going to be talking about, the one we talked about last time and the one we're going to talk about next time. Could we get out of the records the pleas of the families to have access to the children that were killed? Can we get the family side of those two stories, which we haven't had? Representative Anderson, Representative Jensen, talking about the rights of families to have access to their children, and I'd like us to have in evidence the pleas of the families to have access to the children that were killed. And if you could provide that were killed by the families, if you could provide that for us, that would be very helpful, I think.
Chair Dalto and Representative Greenlick, I just need to make sure I understand your question. Your request is that in the two cert processes we've been through, that families who were the families of the one child who was injured and another child who is deceased, that you want the information from those families to come forward. I'm confused by what the request is.
My request is Representative Anderson, Representative Jensen, both talked about how families' rights were being trampled. Families come and say, we are entitled to have our children. We are entitled to have access to our children. We are entitled to have visitation with our children.
Right.
And I think that's a very important thing because we hear from our clients, we hear from our constituents on that issue a lot, how you don't respect the rights of families. We had two disastrous families here, and we're hearing about in those situations how the agency may have screwed up in not protecting the children enough from their families. But I'd like to see the other side of that story. I'd like to see the extent to which those families had the same thing, came to you with pleas to have access to their children. I'd like to see the family side.
Okay.
Of the stories that ended up as disasters because the family's wishes were, to a certain extent, dealt with.
Chair Dalto and Representative Greenlee, how we might go about that, I think a strategy would be, now some of the family members have appeared on television and they have talked openly about their perspectives on the case, and certainly that is the right of those families to do that. I believe if those families have legal representation, the place the committee would want to work through would be their attorneys, because their attorneys they may have certain information they want to have come forward, and if they have legal representation, there may be information they don't want to come forward for a reason unknown to me. But I'm not sure we would feel that we could bring those families in to provide testimony, because the families voluntarily can do that. But it puts us in a difficult position given our role with the cases, and we certainly don't want to be seen as exploiting a family member, and I know that's not what you're asking. So I think technically how we would get to that.
Look, I understand what the point that Representative Greenlick is trying to make, as well as Representative Anderson and Jensen. I think there's a way that we can do that. We'll explore it privately.
Thank you.
And we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could I?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Representative Kelly.
Yeah. I think an issue that you haven't discussed yet is CASA. And it seems to me that CASA is representing the child, looking in the best interest of the child, which is different from the best interest or whatever the best interest proclaimed by the agency as opposed to the best interest of the family. So my question is, what proportion of children do have a CASA representative, and at what point are they appointed, and maybe that's enough.
Chair Dalto and Representative Tomei, from this little block, it appears on here that most of the CASA representation would happen at that jurisdictional hearing. Becky Smith, who is actually director of the state CASA program, which is housed at the Commission on Children and Families, when I spoke with her about this some months back, I believe our representation is in the neighborhood of 30% of the children who are in foster care actually have a CASA. The CASA, I would want to go on record, is an excellent program. It is the a way of having objective eyes looking at a case. That individual does look out for the interest of the child, and when that individual comes to court, that is what they're there for, is sort of to be the eyes and ears of the child. And that is even if the child does have an attorney representing the child's interest. So I would say that we have a system in the state to have more CASAs, but I think if Becky Smith were here to testify, she would talk about the resources to keep that system in place and have, and these are volunteers. CASAs are volunteers, so they don't have any obligation to the agency, and that's one of the unique and really wonderful approaches about that program.
I'd be interested in hearing more. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Duff, I'll take us then to the jurisdictional hearing. So within the first 60 days, we are back into court again to actually have a determination by the judge around the allegations that were filed in the petition. And so those are then, at that point in time, proven, or people may actually voluntarily agree to, yes, these facts are actually true. The court may then at that point in time assign temporary custody to the department, and we would then be ordered to provide a range of services to the family that oftentimes entails drug and alcohol treatment or assessments. It may include psychological evaluations for the purposes of treatment decisions. And that, again, is where a CASA may be requested by any party of the case and or assigned if possible. That's also the piece then within the first 60 days where we go into yet another family type meeting, and it's the Oregon Family Decision Meeting, and that's where, again, we're bringing a group of folks together who are involved in that case, from the relatives to the foster parents to any sort of treatment providers at that point for the children and families, and developing ongoing then decisions around the service agreement, which is what the family's agreeing to do, what we're agreeing to do is what a basic service agreement is, and it's also developing the plan then about a concurrent plan. And what that means is that we're required to have a concurrent plan, meaning that our plan is to return this child home when and if at all possible. On the chance that that is not going to happen, what is our concurrent plan? So we need to make a decision then early on around, if the child is unable to go back home to mother or father, then we also be looking at, is grandma, who may be caring for the child at that point in time, willing and potential to be able to be a guardian or adoptive parent to this child. So from the very early on, we're supposed to be talking with families and the courts around what is our concurrent plan in case this doesn't happen. And that's really a requirement so that children do not stay in foster care and languish there for years and years with no plan in place. That piece then really takes us into, it drops down to the next block of ongoing case management. And the ongoing case management is just an array of services that are provided with the family, and it will entail everything from a visitation plan. We have visits for children and their families on a real regular basis. It is also then looking at what are we providing ongoing, and so the service agreement may be updated routinely. It also then includes the array of face-to-face contacts with the children and the families throughout the casework. So that, when we talked earlier this week around an ongoing caseworker, that is really kind of the heart of their work in many ways, of doing that whole business of services. The next piece around the judicial review is that within, it is really the discretion of the judge of how often we actually come back in the hearing within some parameters. And so if a child is in foster care, we need to be reviewing that child's foster care placement with the courts at least every 6 months. And from some courts, it may be that they are assigning the Citizens Review Board that we spoke of earlier this week, who are actually then a group of citizens that will be reviewing those cases. And they're doing it as an arm of the court and providing recommendations then to the judge. We also have some areas where the judge may actually want to hear that case personally, and so they may actually call us back in for a hearing. And it is based really on the court decision how often those cases are going to be heard, with the caveat that they must be heard at least every 6 months, at least by the Citizen Review Board. All along this time, the child may be returned back home at any of these junctures. And it may be after a Citizens Review Board, it may be after a court hearing. And so the child is sent home at many different junctures throughout the case. This is not as prescribed as it looks like here on a flow chart. Within then the first 12 to 14 months, we are then back in court again having a permanency hearing. And the essence of that permanency hearing is, again, to explain to the judge the progress of the family or lack of progress that the family is making, and what is that plan for the child. Is that child going to go back home? And if so, when? Is that child not going to go back home? And if so, then are we going to implement the concurrent plan, meaning moving towards guardianship or adoption for that child with other family members or whoever? So at that point, it's all parties again back to the case in front of the judge explaining, yes, mom's doing her drug treatment. She's got about another 60 days in this treatment center and maybe coming back home. We then have the ability to say we'd like to continue working with this mother and this family. It may be that the attorneys on the case may be saying for the child, no, that's not what we want to keep happening. And so it is the judge's decision then to say, DHS, we find that you've made a reasonable effort to continue working with this family. Nevertheless, we're here at 12 months or 14 months. We want you to start moving towards implementing the concurrent plan. And at that point in time, we would be moving towards another direction.
On the concurrent plan, how many children that are moving to some sort of permanency outside of their home come from environments that were drug-related? And you may not have that information that you could bring
up. I do not. We'd certainly have to get it to you, but it would certainly be, you know, a significant number. The
Representative Anderson.
Go ahead. Finish up.
I was going to move us on, so your question's ready.
After the permanency hearing, the judge has said essentially the state takes back custody of the child.
At the permanency hearing, we have been assigned custody, legal custody of that child from the shelter hearing on. So each hearing, the court is basically reconfirming that that child is still in the legal care and custody of the state assigned to Department of Human Services.
I guess what I'm asking is, after the permanency hearing, I assume custody is with the state.
Correct.
And yet you have these concurrent paths. It would seem that you've been, in the hearing, you've been trying to get the children away from the birth or maybe an adoptive family. And now you're saying, it doesn't seem like it's an equal concurrent plan, that you're essentially moving toward adoption at that state, at that point. Unless something miraculous steps in and says, well, no, the adoptive family or birth family, maybe we ought to reconsider them. I have a couple of cases in Grants Pass that I think possibly we need more fairness at that level, too, that the case can be reconsidered and looked at by the agency, not by the court, but by the agency, because the court really doesn't come into this at this point where there's concurrent plans, except to say, okay, we agree with adoption, we agree with guardianship, or we agree with reunification. I mean, it's just kind of a final stamp, as I see it. Is there really the freedom for the agency to come back in at that point and say, oops, you know, maybe we made a mistake. Maybe we've got some parents here that really are capable of learning, capable of undergoing the anger management and the parenting skills.
Chair Dalto and Representative Anderson, a little later you're going to hear from Nancy Miller, who will speak from the court perspective and Citizens Review Board. The concurrent plan is a very serious option that has to be looked at. This came out of the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act, and it came out in regards to something that Representative Butler mentioned the other day, and that is the time frame under which the agency is operating to make a decision about the ability of the child to be able to go back home safely or whether or not there has to be another plan. If there is progress being made with the family, and if you have treatment providers who come and say, while this parent's not ready to have the child returned yet, I think with some more work, I believe there's a good prognosis here, then that can be a reason for the agency to say to the court, we are at this point in time when we have to come up with a recommendation. The child cannot go back home, but at the same time, the court can order us to continue providing those services to families. The purpose of the concurrent plan was it was seen when it was passed in federal legislation as a more honest way of working with parents to say to parents, if your child comes into the foster care system anywhere in this country, what we can't do is have your child grow up in the foster care system. The government is not seen as a good enough parent to have children stay in foster care indefinitely. And so the idea was to be very honest with parents and say, we're going to work with you during this very critical period of time, 6 months, a year, 18 months, but if those plans are not able to help you safely parent your children, we will have another plan in place, and we won't wait 18 months and then start talking about, well, what is the next plan? Because if you remember, when the federal government passed that law, when Congress passed the law, it was because the length of time of children in foster care in this country was abysmal in terms of children being multiply placed from one foster home to the other and staying in care for years. So the idea was to kind of force the department to make, and the judge to make, earlier decisions about where will this child end up permanently. I think a bit of what it feels like a train wreck for us right now is when, in the best of all times and when all services are available, I think all of us are more comfortable with saying we then can move this case forward, because if parents can't be safe within a year and a half, and they've had access to all the services. Where that conversation, though, really begins to impact, and what you all see in your communities is, what if the services are not there? What if there's not enough of the services, or the services aren't the right kind of services for the parents? And that's a huge dilemma, I think, but the court has to address that every day. They're having to take that issue on.
And I appreciate the sensitivity of that. Can I follow that? I think one thing that... Ooh, I lost it. I'll get back to it.
We'll come back.
Oh, I wanted to ask as well, how long does the ASFA, is that a year that they have to work the concurrent?
Chair Dalto and Representative Anderson, generally the concurrent plan will begin formation during that first year, and it's something that we would be discussing with Citizens Review Board. And one thing I wanted to clarify, Citizens Review Board is every 6 months, and by law, you have to go into court every year. You can't continue to only to have Citizens Review Board. There has to be the oversight of the court. But the concurrent plan generally will start at the point that the agency and the family are beginning to understand that the family, for some reason, they're either not going to treatment, they're not participating, they haven't been showing up for visitation. So the point at which the concurrent plan is discussed may begin earlier in some cases than the other.
And if I understood you correctly, that can be extended if there seems to be progress.
Chair Dalto and Representative Anderson, it can be. And those are cases that we would be going to court, and the judge might say, I see enough progress that I'm going to make an exception from the congressionally mandated 15 out of 22 months. The Adoption and Safe Families Act said if the child has been in care for 15 out of the most recent 22 months, the agency really should be pressing for a decision around permanency with the court. And so we actually track how many cases we are at that point with the 15 out of 22 months and how many of those cases are not ready to move towards the concurrent plan. And again, the court system, Nancy Miller and those also track those statistics, and we'll be able to share some of that information.
Short. The Alzheimer's is fading, and I did remember what I was going to ask. We have a common problem. The parents oftentimes are told, if you'll do this and this and this and this, you are pretty assured you're going to get your children back. I've had that several times, and then they are moving in a track that looks like they never were meaning that. That is a problem we need to deal somehow with, either not saying anything. I kid people. I saw a friend who had orthodontics the other day, and the braces, you know, they're on for a couple of years, and having had a brother who was an orthodontist, they never tell a patient when those braces are coming off until the day they're coming off, because otherwise they'll get bugged to death. And I understand the same thing goes here. It'd be better not to tell people anything than to tell them, yeah, you'll get your kids back if you do anger control.
Chair Dalto and Representative Anderson, if we could take care of that one problem alone, it would probably cut your constituent concerns at least half. One of the things we've identified, and this is really the CERT review is helping us identify, the confusion sometimes that staff have about when they say to the parent, if you do the following four things, then you will be able to have your children back. Well, if those four things are things that simply are compliance-driven, in other words, if you will go to a parenting class. They may go to the parenting class, they may sit there. They still may not be a safer parent. And the piece we're going to take on as a result of these two certs and what we've seen in these cases is staff have to start thinking about what is it that makes you know or helps you to know a parent is going to be a safer parent. Not that they went and participated in a class, but where is the competency of being a safer parent? And I think sometimes our staff, they want so much to be able to work with the family that it's easy to kind of fall into a seductive way of saying if you do the following four things, then you can have your children back. Our staff should never say that because, in essence, that is a decision also that's going to be made with the court and with the CASA and with the Citizens Review Board. But I very much appreciate that comment, that observation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
I think that actually brings us to the end of that page anyway, unless there's more questions.
Mr. Jensen.
A question, you said it brings you at the end of the page. Do you have some more that where you're going or where you're at in your testimony?
Chair Dalto and Representative Jensen, I apologize. I just told him to finish up. I thought we were about to the end, and okay. If the bottom in those permanency options, I mean, we really, what we wanted to do for you all today, Chair Dalto would ask us to focus on the foster care piece and this child protective service piece. And so at some point, you may want to hear about these other options, but we were just in the spirit of watching the time, because I know you had other things on the agenda.
Representative, Chair Dalto. Could I make some comments and observations here?
Yes, sir, by all means.
Before we move on, and I do apologize. I know your time is, and it's a difficult managing time in topics like this. I'm very appreciative of that. First of all, I'm not sure whether I want to compliment my colleague for knowing what I was in. After or intending to do or what my concerns were, because quite frankly I'm not sure that I knew always myself what I knew and or what I was asking for.
We're here to help you.
Yeah, you're here to help. You're from the government. I understand that. This whole issue is a topic that is that's very near and dear to my heart. It also, as you are aware and as you've heard from testimony here, and as some of our newer members of the committee will soon find out when they get back out into the district, it is one of the areas we as legislators probably get more constituent issues on than any other department that we have in state government. So, it is something that we're pretty genuinely, concerned about. And as far as this is concerned, committee members, fellow committee members, you will appreciate that in the last, the 03 session, I was the one who got the quote-unquote Jensen Amendment into the statutes as far as reporting is concerned. So, in fact, Representative, when you reported the child running across the road, that would at least today be a statutory requirement that you report it. You couldn't. And it would have been an offense, you know, findable offense not to have done so. You know, because I see legislators as public officials in this capacity, and our responsibility, I feel we all have a real deep responsibility. The thing I'm concerned with, and where my questions were coming from and going to, at least I, when I deal with constituents on these issues, is I need to, you know, my first thing to them is, you know, to tell them I'm not going to micromanage the case. That's not my job. I don't have, and even if I had the technical professional expertise to do so, that's not what my job as a legislator, as your legislator, would be. My job is to ensure that the agency has followed their prescribed process that they go through. And so therefore the reason for trying to understand your process so that I can, you know, always, you know, deal with the issues, the very real issues that come before us, and sometimes the process isn't followed, at which point then I have a very different approach that I have to take than the cases where the process is followed with it. So my questions were, and my concerns were meant solely in that respect, to make sure that I understand what the process is, and if there's a need for a change in the process, that's what we obviously as a committee and you as a management, you know, need to work out in kind of another sort of form. So just to clarify, you know, what my intentions, you know, may have been with that. Thank you, Chair Dalton. I appreciate your indulging me on this.
Oh, my pleasure, Representative Jensen. And just sort of a note to the committee, you know, it's sometimes difficult to schedule how much time we're going to go on some of these informational meetings because we get into areas that are so complicated and that we want to sort of draw out with questions to try to further our understanding. So I appreciate it very much that you've been bearing with us these past couple of meetings, and I know they go a little bit long, and I'm not sure if you received an email from us yet, but our intention is to try to have you schedule about 2 hours for these meetings in the future, sort of as a rule of thumb, and we will try to finish sooner than 2 hours if that opportunity presents itself. And we're doing these informational hearings in these couple of weeks right now, but eventually we'll move on to our bill flow when we start receiving more bills and start doing those, and so those won't always go as long as these informational hearings have been going. But I appreciate your sensitivity, your willingness to stick it out on getting this information, and we'll probably today go another half an hour or less and be done for this week. So thank you for your patience. Thanks. So do you have anything else? Okay, I appreciate you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm sure I know how what I'm supposed to do.
Sure. Next, we'll invite Nancy Miller up, please, who is the Deputy State Court Administrator, who is overseeing the Court and Citizens Review Board process that works with these foster care cases. And Nancy, you have somebody with you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thanks for sticking out. I'll be here until midnight.
Thank you, Bill, for doing it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations. In that capacity, I also serve as the Director of the Citizen Review Board Program. And with me today is Timothy Travis. Timothy is an attorney. He is our court improvement manager in the Oregon Judicial Department and an all-around expert on juvenile law. So I asked him to be here with us today. I was asked by the chair to talk a little bit about the oversight functions that the court and the Citizen Review Board program provide. Before I do that, I just want to address a couple of the issues that came up during your questioning in terms of how the law has developed over about the past 7 years. We've seen a sea change in child welfare law in this state, and I think talking about that very briefly might add some context. In 1997, this body passed Senate Bill 689, which was affectionately known as the Best Interest of the Child Bill. That bill made some dramatic changes in the way this state looks at child abuse and neglect cases. That bill put timelines on parents. That bill put a burden on parents after a one-year period of time to show, in fact, that they were ready to have their children returned, or as Ramona talked about, we then move on to another plan. Later in 1997, Congress followed this body's lead, and I always say that Oregon was on the forefront of these changes. Congress passed the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which was implemented in this state through the 1999 passage of Senate Bill 408. Senate Bill 408 and the Adoption and Safe Families Act made it crystal clear that the child's health and safety are the paramount concern in child abuse and neglect cases. What led to that sea change was a practice over the years, with all due respect, of the agency and the courts and everybody else, giving parents chance after chance after chance after chance while children languished in foster care. So what Congress said and what this body said was returning children to their parents remains the primary permanent plan that everybody shoots for. So these concurrent plans are just-in-case plans. Return to parent is always the primary plan, but the child's health and safety is the paramount concern. So that's the balance that we strike in child welfare in this state and now in the country as a whole. So I hope that at least lend some context to that balance that you were asking about earlier. In terms of oversight, what I've handed you, this first page, and there are some handouts in the back, this first page is the chart that shows the Court and Citizen Review Board oversight, and I'm not going to go through all of this at great length because you've been here for a long time and Kevin touched on some of it. But as he explained to you, the shelter hearing happens within 24 hours. The next sheet behind your checklist or your graph are the issues that the court considers at the shelter hearing. So again, in context of what Kevin was talking about earlier, there's a team decision meeting to talk about placement, and then there's a check on that decision by the court. So what you see throughout the life of a child welfare case is a decision by the agency, a check by the court. A decision by the agency, a check by the court. The court can overturn almost all of the decisions that are made by the agency. So the court has the ultimate authority in every decision, I would say, and Timothy will leap right in and correct me if I'm wrong, with the exception of actual placement decisions. It is the agency who makes the decision about what home a child gets placed in. But whether or not the child stays in care, whether the plan is appropriate, whether the services are appropriate, all of those decisions are checked by the court and ultimately decided by the court. So there is a heavy-duty system of checks and balances in place in these child welfare cases. Quickly, at the shelter hearing, and just want to hit a couple of high points. At the shelter hearing, probably the most important decision that is made is whether the agency made reasonable efforts to prevent the placement. Shelter care is not, or foster care is not the first resort. I forgot to say when I started, I used to be a caseworker, so I have walked in these shoes. I have done these investigations. I have made these difficult decisions. And I will tell you that there is nothing harder than walking into a family, listening to a terrible tale, making a decision to leave a child at home, and spending the entire night awake, waiting for the school to open the next morning so that you can get on that telephone and pray that those kids are there and that those kids are safe. The converse decision, you walk into a family, you take those children away, and you spend the entire night awake knowing what you've caused with that family. So there's no win. There's no win. These are terrible, terribly difficult decisions. So, back to the shelter hearing, sorry. The reasonable efforts finding is one of the most crucial findings that the court's going to make. Foster care is the last resort. The agency is required when they go into these homes to make a decision about whether there are any services that can prevent that placement. So you don't just go in and say, gosh, there's been a concern expressed, foster care's it. You go in and say, there's been a concern expressed, are there services that can keep this child at home? And the court will make a finding about whether or not the agency did that. In terms of additional people involved in the case at the shelter hearing, you will have attorneys appointed. You will sometimes have a CASA appointed. As Ramona said, CASAs are often appointed later in the case. Because of the resource, the court really takes a look at which cases really, really need the services of a CASA because we don't have CASAs for all the cases. At the shelter hearing, the court will then set the date for further proceedings.
Also at the shelter hearing, again, for the record, I'm Timothy Travis, and I'd like the committee to know that I am an attorney. I have represented abused and neglected children in Multnomah County. I have also functioned as a CASA in Multnomah County, so I have represented these children directly, visited them in their foster homes. These are real people to me. These are not just stories in the newspaper. At the shelter hearing, the court is required to make one finding in addition to a reasonable efforts finding. The court is required to make a finding that it is in the best interest of this child to be removed from his or her home. And that is a finding that the court has to make by federal law. And if the court finds that it is not in the best interest of this child to be removed from his or her home, then the agency does not get money from the federal government to support that foster care finding. Congress specifically made that requirement to put the court, to set the court up as the gatekeeper to prevent unnecessary removals of children. So the court has to make that finding. And if that finding is not made in the first order, in the shelter order, then that case will never be eligible for foster care subsidy throughout the time that it's in the case, in the system. That means that you cannot go, oops, we forgot on Tuesday to make that finding, and come back on Wednesday and make that finding. Can't do it.
So the court is always considering, is the placement in the child's best interest, and is there probable cause to move forward on the petition? So at the shelter hearing, if the court finds there is no probable cause and it's not in the child's best interest, the child goes home. So as Ramona was saying, that can happen at any step along the way. The next hearing, and there are usually several different court things going on between these two hearings, the next hearing that would be scheduled is 60 days out, and that's the jurisdiction disposition hearing. The jurisdictional hearing in juvenile court is like the trial in adult court. The burden of proof is lower in juvenile court. You're all aware, I'm sure, of the beyond the reasonable doubt standard in criminal court. In juvenile court, it's a preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not, that the situation occurred. Before the jurisdictional dispositional hearing, there will often be settlement conferences, discussions about whether or not we need to go to a full-blown trial in the case. If there is a full-blown trial, the court will make a decision at that point whether or not the allegations are substantiated, and the court will take jurisdiction in the case. If it's settled earlier, the parents are likely to admit.
Representative Greenlink.
Thank you, sir. Are both the parents and the child represented by attorneys that are assigned by indigent defense or other things at that point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlink, the parents and the attorneys are eligible for, or are entitled to court-appointed counsel if they are eligible. and this is something that Representative Anderson was talking about, we have a process where where court staff do some figuring to determine whether someone's eligible, and then turn that financial information over to the court, and then the court makes the determination and will appoint counsel if they are eligible.
Hey, Paul, is the child always represented by counsel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, what the statute says is that the child gets a lawyer if someone requests it. Some courts appoint attorneys in all cases for children. Some courts do not.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along that line, I found to my distaste that a number of the attorneys who do represent the children are paid so poorly, or you know, there's really not much of a compensation, that they don't spend much time. I had one case where the attorney had never met, had never talked to, had never seen, didn't even know the children, but he was in court every time representing the children. I think that's an abuse.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I would guarantee that the Public Defense Services Commission would be happy to come and talk to you about the challenges.
Personal friend.
if I may, Representative Anderson, the quality of the work of people who are public defenders, like the quality of the work of people who are caseworkers, like the quality of the work of people who fill potholes in the street,
yeah,
is uneven.
Right.
You will find some of the finest legal representation in Oregon is available to children in some law firms in some places. You will find there is a need for substantial improvement in other places. There has been an assessment of Oregon courts done within the last year, and there are recommendations that have been made about all aspects of court operations, and one of the aspects of court operations that's zeroed in on is the quality of lawyering that's done not only for children but for parents. And the Public Defense Services Commission is working on a plan to educate attorneys and make sure they're up to snuff and make sure they understand their ethical obligations. So there are good and there are bad attorneys, and as Nancy said, we want to find the bad ones and we want to help them get better, or we want to eliminate them from the list.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, in light of your question the other day asking what are the solutions, possible solutions, we'll provide you with that assessment of the courts. It makes numerous recommendations directed to the courts, lawyers, CASAs, CRB agency, and it's a really good report. We'll provide that to you.
Everybody's got improvement.
And are there, in the point that Representative Anderson makes, are there any set of guidelines or any sort of standards that attorneys representing children have to meet in terms of how many you know, meetings at all they might have with the child or anything like that? How does that work?
Mr. Chair, yes, there are. And those standards right now are under review and are being revised. I was on the committee that wrote the standards the first time around. They've been adopted by the state bar. I will say, in all fairness to the attorneys, then you've heard this before, caseloads of lawyers make it extremely difficult to meet all the standards. And as Timothy's chairing a committee of our Juvenile Court Improvement Project in cooperation with the Public Defense Services Commission to look at additional training on those standards and improvements across the state.
Maybe you can get us some information about that. Representative Jensen.
Just a quick question. Do judges have any latitude in calling the attorneys who are doing an inadequate or unprofessional job to task in chambers or something to?
Representative Jensen, of course they do. Of course they do. They also have the ability to report attorneys who they don't think are doing well to the Public Defense Services Commission, and they have the power to say, you're not going to do this anymore.
Yeah.
One of the things to keep in mind in terms of these standards and in terms of what Nancy said earlier about the changes since 1997, we have seen great changes in the system since 1997 on paper. But don't forget that you're dealing with human beings and systems. We have not caught up with all those changes yet. We are in the midst of a transition from a child welfare system before the 1970s that was set up to deal with one set of problems to one now that's dealing with a society awash in drug and alcohol problems. We haven't caught up with that yet, and everybody's working very hard to catch up with the changes that have been required in the past 10 years, but we're not there yet.
Greenlee.
Mr. Chair, my son was for some time the chief juvenile attorney for the Portland Metropolitan Defenders, and I got to hear a lot about the perspective that is. We might want to ask an organization like that or others to come in and talk about it, their perspective as they represent the individual child in these proceedings. I think you'd find it quite interesting.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I know that the Juvenile Rights Project, who represents a large number of children in the Portland metropolitan area, would be very interested in working with the committee on these issues. Okay, moving through the checks and balances. I'm going to skip over the permanency hearing, which is next in your packet, and move to the Citizen Review Board, because now we're at 6 months into the case. The Citizen Review Board was created by the Oregon Legislature in 1985. These reviews are required by federal law. Oregon has made the decision to have those reviews done by panels of trained citizens. What you're getting through the CRB is public input into government decisions. We are an arm of the court. Our reviews look very much like a court hearing, but they're done by a panel of citizens instead of by a judge. The recommendations from the Citizen Review Board go to the agency, to the court, and to all the parties. The agency is required by law to implement those recommendations or respond to the board in writing if they do not intend to do so. In the checklist that you see on page 9 of your materials, and I'm not going to run through it all, you see all the issues that the Citizen Review Board considers in that first review. Behind that, I've provided for you a list of the questions that the board will ask to the caseworker and all of the parties that are present. I know that Representative Jensen was concerned the other day about constituent concerns that you had heard about the board being a rubber stamp, a term that quite frankly drives me crazy. I did go back and look at the data that we collect on that issue, and we do disagree with DHS in about one out of every four cases. That does not mean that we disagree totally. We agree totally with the agency 75% of the time. I think that's a good thing. 22% of the time, we have recommendations about the services. We believe that there are services missing. We believe that there are concerns with the case plan. And 3% of the time, we completely disagree with the agency in terms of the plan that the agency has adopted. So,
Representative Jensen.
And the 3% of the time where you disagree, are you able to work toward some agreement at a subsequent date?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, again, in this situation, it's the court that's the final arbiter. We send our recommendations to the court. DHS can ask for a court hearing if they disagree with us, and the court will make the final decision. But frankly, most often, we do work with the agency to get on the same page. So the Citizen Review Board reviews the case every 6 months unless the case has been reviewed by the court and the court waives the citizen review. We have a very clear process in place to make sure that we are not duplicating reviews so that we don't have caseworkers running back and forth to citizen review and court hearings in the same six-month period. Do we drop the ball on that now and then? Yes. Do we try as hard as we can to make sure that that is not happening? Yes. The last hearing that Kevin talked about, going back in your materials to page 6, is the permanency hearing. That happens 12 months after jurisdiction or 14 months after the child came into care, whichever comes first. The permanency hearing was used to be referred to by an old friend of mine as the Fisher cut date hearing. This is the point in time where the court is faced and the agency is faced with making a decision
about whether return to parent remains the appropriate goal or whether the, as Kevin talked about, the concurrent plan needed to be implemented as the primary plan. One thing I do want to clarify, though, is that these permanency goals that you saw in DHS's handout, return to parent, adoption, guardianship, and then planned permanent living arrangement, permanent foster care, come in a line of priority. So the priority plan is always return to parent. Every time, until the parent's rights are terminated, every time the court reviews the case, the court always needs to go back, CRB as well, needs to go back and say, is return to parent viable? Is adoption viable? Is guardianship viable? Why are we doing permanent foster care? So that is an ongoing exploration in these cases until they close, always. And that's federal requirement. And quite frankly, we didn't do so well on the first federal review of that requirement. So the performance measures that have been adopted for the Judicial Department, and I heard someone inquiring about performance measures the other day, the performance measures that have been adopted for the Judicial Department really focused on making sure that we were going back and we were inquiring at every review, is return to parent appropriate? What about adoption? If not, what about adoption? What about guardianship and permanent foster care last resort?
And let me emphasize that even if the agency comes in at the permanency hearing and says, we believe that adoption is the plan for this child, the court does not start with examining whether adoption is the best plan for this child. The court starts with, why isn't return to parent appropriate for this child? And the court must make written findings that are in the permanency order that says why return to parent is not appropriate for this child. And if adoption is not appropriate and they're going to go down to guardianship, they have to, and they not only make the findings about return home, then they have to make the findings about adoption to get to guardianship. And then if they're going to go below guardianship to permanent foster care, they have to make written findings to get down that far. So you have to make three sets of findings to keep a kid in permanent foster care. So when that permanency hearing starts, the parent once again has the opportunity to put on evidence to show that this child should be returned, even if the agency is coming in and saying adoption is the plan.
One more thing about the CRB that I want to explain. Statutorily, the Citizen Review Board has a dual role, both to review cases and to make recommendations about policies, procedures, and laws affecting the substitute care system. I sit on the Child Welfare Advisory Committee that Ramona talked to you about. The Citizen Review Board and the courts both are, if you will, kind of in a catbird seat looking at the system because we see so many thousands of cases. We really have a systemic view of what's going on, and we have made numerous policy recommendations. I'd be happy to share some of those with you. I know, Representative Tomei, you were saying you wanted to hear some solutions. We do have some. I know your time is limited today, so you can decide if you want to hear this quickly today or at some other time. Also, I want to bring to your attention, I'm not sure if you're aware, that Tuesday afternoon, the 25th, Joint Judiciary, Ways and Means, Human Services Subcommittee, and the Public Safety Subcommittee will be doing an overview of the entire child welfare process. We'll be doing a skit that kind of walks a case through the child welfare process. We'll have all the mock case materials so that you can actually see in a fake case what a juvenile court case looks like, what a DHS case looks like. So that'll be in the large hearing room, 1 o'clock on Tuesday, if you want to watch that.
Is that F?
F.
When you say large.
So if we have any time, I'll tell you some of the recommendations we've made, and if not, I'd be happy to come back.
Go ahead.
Just a couple of key things on recommendations. You and I've spoken to Ramona about these. You heard the other day about caseloads being overwhelming, caseloads getting in the way of people being able to do their work. I think it's very important for the committee to know, and Ramona shared with me, Representative Tomei, that she'd given some information to you, that we have heard testimony by the agency director for the past probably 3 or 4 years that the agency is staffed very close to the recommended national average, and that's 1 to 20 children. What's happening, and these policy decisions predate Ramona, and she has been working very diligently on them. What's happened is we have built a system with so many non-case-carrying positions that the case-carrying positions are overwhelmed. So that's an internal agency management decision that can be made, and she and I are in discussions about that. Another area of concern that we have is the response to the oversight that the CRB does and the court does, and Ramona and I are in conversations about requiring supervisory review anytime a court makes a negative reasonable efforts finding, or a CRB makes a negative reasonable efforts finding, or a CRB says that the agency isn't in compliance with its own case plan. So I think that there's some internal management things that can be done to really beef up the agency's response to the oversight that it receives. I have said for years that CSD, then SCF, then DHS, is an agency with excellent policy in place. Somewhere between the policy development and the implementation, there's some sort of a synapse break. We've talked a lot about how to help caseworkers get training on policies as they develop. And you heard the caseworkers the other day talking about, you know, we keep getting these new policies and they keep adding things. The face-to-face policy is something that we started working with Ramona on before she even came to Oregon. I called her when she was still in South Carolina and said, this is our number one issue. We really care about face-to-face contact. And she has come helped the agency come a very, very long way in that regard. The other key policy issue that we're working on right now with the agency is one that we call rate redesign. The way the rates are set for foster care payments in the agency, in my humble opinion, there is an incentive to keep children in permanent foster care rather than to pursue guardianship or adoption because it pays more. So we're working very hard with the agency on rate redesign. My other main concern that I've shared with Ramona has to do with the way caseworkers are assigned. In the best case scenario, you're going to get, in most branches, four caseworkers. You're going to get the protective services worker. You heard the workers identify themselves the other day as permanency workers. You're going to get a protective service worker. You're going to get an ongoing worker after that. You're going to get a permanency worker after that. And you're going to get an adoption worker after that. Now, that's assuming no one leaves, no one transfers, and this is a mobile population because it's a very, very, very difficult job. We have said for a very long time, one worker, one lawyer, one CASA, one judge, 1 year. So if I could leave you with anything, one worker, one lawyer, one CASA, one judge, 1 year. Done. Thank you. Happy to respond to any questions.
If I could leave you with one thought, it would be to reiterate what I said earlier. A lot of changes have been made in this system in the last 10 years. A lot has been required of everyone in the last 10 years in this system to do business in a different way than they've done it before. Not everyone in this system has caught up with all of the things that they are required to do. And no one has caught up with all of the things they're required to do. So we are still in a transition into this new ASFA-based system. And so when I say the court does this and the court does that, I bet you could go out and find a place in Oregon where the court's not doing that. But we're working on it.
Representative Boone.
I just have had a couple of, since these higher profile cases have come out in the paper, a couple of constituents have called me and said, well, that's to be expected when you have eight children or whatever in the home. They're doing it as a business. That's what they make their money. That's how they make their money. So how would we respond to something like that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, as Timothy said, and this is Timothy's favorite line, performance is uneven. I would certainly not like to paint the majority of foster parents with that brush, ever. I think that you can find the anomaly in any system. I do think we need to build a system that doesn't provide incentives for keeping kids in care.
But I guess in what these people, to go on, and I'll keep it just really short, their comments were, if these were medically needy children, isn't there some sort of cap on how many children a family can adequately care for and do a good job, and not, incite that reaction, because there's obviously a disconnect within those homes in that sense. And I understand that. I got to say, if you've been a caseworker and this is where you are now, and I'm guessing you're about 35, so
absolutely,
you've basically given your career to this life,
yes,
and this work, and that's very admirable, and I commend you for it. And Timothy, I asked Carolyn, who came in, Representative Tomei, who you were, because I know I've seen you around. You've been here for a long time, in and out of this building.
Well, my first session was 93. Up until 1997, I was working session and then going back and representing children as part of as my job. And only since the 99 session have I been full-time with the Judicial Department.
But I recognize you from... I've been here since 89, so...
Yeah, I've been around the block.
See you.
And you're less than 35.
She was a page at the age of 8.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, thank you for that. I will tell you that this is my passion. It is Timothy's passion. Mm-hmm. I don't believe there's any more important work that this state does, and I just want to say that you have a Chief Justice in this state who supports the work of the juvenile courts like I have never seen in any other state, and he is just the greatest. And because of his hard work, we have a cadre of juvenile court judges now. When I first started with the Judicial Department, juvenile court was where you went until you learned how to put your robe on straight, and then you went downtown to do real law. Juvenile court is where you go now if you want to make a difference. And to me, I mean, that's just the, end result of my career, so I'm thrilled.
And let me say, as somebody who came into the system as a gunslinging litigator looking for bad guys to punish because they were beating up on our children, I haven't found those bad guys yet.
Right.
Everybody in this system, the CASAs, the caseworkers, everybody in this system wants to do the right thing for kids. They may be more or less able to do that, but they all have their heart in the right place. Nobody is in this system because of any secondary gain than that.
Committee, would there be any objection to continuing for about 5 more minutes? Is that okay? Okay. Representative Greenlake?
The last comment's a perfect segue into the question I want to ask. We're not here. I'm not, and I'm sure other members here aren't here looking for bad apples. That's not what this is about. I address this comment to Ramona as well as to you, or I hope for some help. I've been pretty familiar with industrial quality control models in the healthcare system, going through total quality management and all the kind of things that went through. And I know there have been attempts to create zero defect systems. NASA, of course, tried to do that in the space program, and we still had Challenger, and we still had Apollo 13, and we still had other problems. I mean, we know it's impossible to get a zero-defect system. But the overwhelming concern is to protect our children, and these are our children, and I've heard you all say that. I mean, just as a father and a grandfather, I'm ferociously dedicated to protecting our children. As representatives of the legislature, we're going to be ferociously dedicated to protecting our children, these thousands of children who are currently our children. And we're going to be balancing, as I said before, the question of the rights of families with the rights of kids, as you point out, this is in here. So what we're going to be looking for is your help in telling us as we move through this, and other people in the audience, other people in the states, help in trying to tell us how can we move towards as close as possible to zero defect models in terms of protecting the children while protecting the rights of parents and understanding we have financial constraints. But even if we had totally unlimited resources, we would not be able to produce a system that didn't have its catastrophes, as there are just too many people involved in this. So what we're going to be asking you to do is help us grope for ways that we can help you create the kind of more perfect system
that we want. And I think the hearing today has been very helpful in my mind to help me continue to consider that as an issue.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think that the most important thing for all of us when these tragedies occur is to take a look, and I've talked to Ramona about this at great length, to stop and I so appreciate what you said, because it's so easy to turn around and say, who did it? You know, who did it? When in fact, people do horrible things to children. People do horrible things to children. And the most that we can do is stop, take stock of our systems, and do exactly what you said, each and every one of us, and say, what could we do differently to protect children and make sure that we are protecting the rights of their parents at the same time? I just think that's beautifully put.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I want to bring Ramona back for just 30 seconds. Representative Carolyn Tomei had a question, and I just had a request. We didn't get to the CERT II report that came out, so if you could get that information to us, if you haven't already done so, for our review, that would be great. Representative Tomei.
Thank you. There was some question that I had asked you earlier in the week, and I was told by Nikki, who was here, that information was sent to us, but I didn't receive a 9S. Sandy?
What?
Chair Dalton, Representative Tomei, you should have in your office, there are two documents we delivered yesterday. We brought the CERT report too that went to the press last night. We wanted you all to have that. And we also brought, there's a cover letter in response to your question, and there are two sheets attached. One is by each SDA, how many caseworkers, how many SSAs, and then the job descriptions and qualifications of those individuals.
Did you deliver those to members' offices?
Or to me?
Representative Dalto and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm Deputy Assistant Director for Program and Policy at CAP. I did deliver them to Representative Dalto's office. It was just before 5 when you had actually about 100 people, I think, about to walk in the office that you were visiting. And
We got them all in, too.
Yeah, yes, you did. I was very surprised. And the door shut. I did notice that. I gave it was a single copy of each of the documents that Ramona mentioned to Ashlyn, and that gave that to you since Representative Tomei asked for the information through this committee. So
I see. Okay. Well, then we'll get copies of that.
Thank you. And for the record, mm-hmm. when the committee asks, just because of the volume of people they deal with, mm-hmm. bring it to us, the committee staff up in 453.
Right.
Just so then the responsibility weighs on my shoulder instead of
Sandy being better contact for you on that.
Thank you.
One last, Representative Tomei, did you get a...
And I'm wondering if you included in that the educational level and the training level of caseworkers?
Chair, Dr. and Representative Tomei, it does include the actual description of each of the jobs, the caseworker's job, the social services supervisor, in terms of what the job is and what the qualifications have to be, our training requirements to be in that level position.
And if you could give us, if I may call it, information about if requiring training, education that is required of caseworkers over the years.
Chair Dalton and Representative Tomei, that may be a little different than what you'll see attached. When you see it attached, it will say things like the social service caseworker has to have a bachelor's degree, for example. And then to be there's something else called a CET. You have to have a year's worth of experience. If you are wanting also for us to say, here's what the training curriculum looks like in terms of child protective service workers, what training they go through, we will also provide that for you as a separate document.
Thank you very much.
One last thing I'd like you to provide also is on your workflow charge, can you give us an indication of where the agency feels the weak points in these various steps are? And you have 10 days or so to work on that for us.
Sure, Dalton, we'd be glad to do that. What we will try to identify are, in the two certs that we have been through now, where in that document we are seeing some really critical points at which we need to spend some time talking about whether or not the approach we have that you see in that current practice document is really the best approach in terms of the kinds of cases we're working on. We'd be glad to do that.
And I would like some more information, not in a hearing, but written information information about your ongoing case management box right here, because I think that's really the heart of where some of the struggles are occurring. So,
Chair Dalton, we'd be glad to get you that as well.
Okay, thank you. Well, thanks for being here, and we're going to
thank you.
Adjourn the meeting.